Hi, this is Jerry Pippen. We're broadcasting from the Laughlin location. The UFO Congress, it's here every year, and we have a very, very special person here helping me, Paula Harris. And Paula, we have two very special people that we've been trying to get on the air for some time, and we've been successful today thanks to your help and their generosity.
I think it's very important, Jerry, that we hear this story because the Dan Burrish story is a very, very important story in the disclosure, the slow process release of information that's coming out. And thanks to Marcia McDowell to provide this opportunity for the average citizen to hear Dan talk, because in the end, it's Dan himself that could provide the answers and nobody else. And I thank you very much for having the courage to come forward, Dan, and do the show.
Well, I'm grateful to be here.
It's good to welcome both of you, Dr. Dan Burrish and Marcy McDowell. We will, if it's okay with me, I'll refer to you as Dan and Marcy from now on.
If you please, yes,
please,
thank you.
That would be better.
And it's okay if I refer to you as Paula, right?
That's okay.
And you can call me whenever
you
want.
I can call you
to.
Jerry now. Yeah. Well, thank you, Jerry.
But remember, we may censor it. Dan and Marcy, let's just start at the beginning here. You were going to college at UNLV and got a contact. I want to get into the education thing later because there's been some controversy there, and we can explain that a little bit, I think.
We can touch on that.
Marcin, if you'd like to, and we'd certainly like to clarify if we could. But that's not really the important reason we're here. We want to talk about how you got interested. Were you interested in things like this? I believe maybe you were a little bit of UFOs.
Well,
and extraterrestrials.
Not so much. No. Not so much. I had an unusual experience in 1973 at Mayboyer Park.
In California.
Yeah. In Southern California. Yeah. That would be the Lakewood area of Southern California. Yeah. A very unusual experience that I really had no answers to for many, many years. It was an experience between myself and my grandfather. We were at the park playing baseball, and all of a sudden the grass around me appeared to turn dark, and the next I remember it was several hours later, and I was looking then at my grandfather several meters away, seated at a tree. He was extremely shook up, and from there was a general degraded atmosphere in the domestic atmosphere of my family. I lived in an extended family with my mom, my dad, my grandma, and my grandpa, and very soon thereafter my grandma and my grandpa, they moved away. And there was great disruptions after this one event. Well, it was kind of put behind me, but I noticed that over the next several years there were, in fact, some changes in my attitudes about things such as science. And
so what we hear about these earth-changing or mind-changing and life-changing experiences actually happened a little bit to you.
Indeed. And in fact, I can disclose a little bit about my personal life here. Following that incident, I remember several occasions where, of course, I was 9 years old at the time, where I would get up in the middle of the night and I would meet my little friend in my house on Steveley Avenue. And I don't have any conscious memory of what my little friend looked like. I remember I called him Harry. And my mom finally convinced me that I was obviously just talking about Oscar the Grouch, because I was still watching Sesame Street, you know, right. Only 9 years old. Certainly there were events going on at the time that I had no particular, real grasp on what had happened to me. Many years later, zooming forward now to post-1994, in the clean sphere, the J-Rod, in fact, informed me that I had been picked up that day at Mayboyer Park.
Yeah, I want to get into the J-Rod story in a little bit here. It's very interesting, Dan and Marcy. Marcy, you two met early on and wrote a book together?
Actually, we met before I wrote the book with Dan. What happened was, after the death of my father, my uncle rather stepped into my life and tried to get me the right education and the right contacts with people, and I ended up being sent to England briefly, and I met Dan at a party in England.
In England?
Yes.
And now you...
Scotland,
and
it was Scotland, but I think of it as England because that's where I ended up going, and then we ended up traveling up, and I met you at this party at Vashti's.
Right. It was at Vashti Bunyan's, the daughter of John Bunyan, the great, great... excelled, the distant removed from John Bunyan, the writer of Pilgrim's Progress. And we had gone up, John and myself had gone up for the weekend to speak with Vashti's husband concerning a Scottish grass sickness issue. And they had a party there, and I rather embarrassed myself when I first took a look at
it. No, please, let me tell it.
Yeah,
please.
Okay, here's Marcy.
Oh, please, here's
Marcy's version.
Oh, you got to
let me
tell it.
No, her version will be the real one.
I mean,
that's why I would rather interrupt her at this point.
Yes, I know you would. I know you would. I saw this young man at the party, and I looked over at him, and, you know, he was, like, looking at me. I smiled at him. The next thing I know, he's backing up, and he stepped in a silver trash can and fell completely down on his...
I fell backward into her kitchen, yes.
In Vashti's kitchen.
Yes. This is
Vashti
Bunyan, the folk
singer. That's a unique
singer.
Approach.
So I did remember
I was smooth
him.
At 16.
Yeah, smooth at 16. So when we finally ran into each other again in the very early 90s, I remembered him because of the trash can incident.
Great.
It's, so now we've got the on record exactly how it happened. Maybe now, Marcy... And Dan, this is really a pleasure having you with you, and I really want to thank Paula for bringing this all together. And Paula, get into this interview and let's talk about a few things.
Well, there's a whole bunch of coincidences I'm seeing here that are not synchronicities. There are synchronicities and coincidences that are, to me, are totally amazing in your story. Knowing each other at an early age, having interaction with an entity when you're young. I mean, somebody orchestrated this thing, Dan. Do you get that feeling that from the beginning somebody orchestrated this thing?
The truth is I get the feeling, yes. Mm-hmm. Can I prove it? No.
No.
There were even synchronicities involving the pathologist that took me under his wing when I was very, very young.
Yeah, and we glossed over that a little bit about why you went to England to begin with. And,
I went to England. This started out, I'll digress, back to the pathologist.
Here, I had been. He's a child prodigy, I think.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes.
But.
Okay.
What happened was my mom introduced me to Dr. James Reynolds, who is a pathologist and chief pathologist at Long Beach Memorial Medical Center in Long Beach, California. I began a tutelage under him for a couple years.
Okay, I got to break in. I've got to break in here.
Okay, go ahead.
I do. I have to. You got to understand something here. We're not talking about a young kid who just happened to meet a doctor over at the hospital. No. Dan was beginning to show incredible talent in the field of biology, and it was so marked and so surprising after this incident where he was abducted that his mom was trying desperately to find out how to channel this incredible, you know, this incredible breakthrough of scientific acumen. So she contacted the doctor, the pathology, chief of pathology at Long Beach Memorial Hospital, brought Dan in for a meeting, and he actually was tested and examined by this doctor for knowledge, and this doctor was so impressed that he brought him in as, what were you, 11?
11 at the 11, time, I believe.
11 years old into the Long Beach Memorial Hospital pathology lab to study histopathology directly under Dr. Reynolds. And he worked with him for approximately 2 years until he was so good at what he did that he was introduced to the Los Angeles Microscopical Society.
I was originally introduced to John DeHaas, who was then a professor at the University of Southern California.
Uh-huh.
And he provided my mom and dad with my first professional microscope, which I still have. It's a 1954 Bausch and Lomb.
Now, when we talk about all of this, all this background is important because it comes into play when you go to UNLV, and as I say, we'll get into the educational thing later, but right. You ended up getting recruited by the Navy Department?
It was Majestic.
Okay.
I wouldn't really say that it was the Navy Department.
Okay.
They gave me a lot of names. They could have said that they were the Admiral of the Kentucky Navy for, you know, it wouldn't have mattered. It was Majestic who was doing the recruiting. And in fact, it was the committee of the majority that was doing the recruiting. I was cutting tissue sections today in Dr. Bert Barbero's laboratory, a parasitologist at the university who I believe went to emeritus status and then retired. And they literally walked into the laboratory, which had been a locked laboratory. They unlocked the door, which was the first surprise to me. So I figured immediately that it was one of the professors who was coming into the lab. And given the sequence of events, I was a little bit nervous that the other professors were coming in, as I had just separated off from a different professor inside the biology department. So they walked in, and I looked around the corner from the small prep laboratory, which separated the histology lab from the actual parasitology lab. That's where I was doing the microtomy. I was doing some sections. I was working just some extra time for him so I could have some lab space cutting some nematode sections for him. And they walked in, and they said, are you Danny Crane? And that was my legal name, Danny mm-hmm. B. Crane. And I indicated, in fact, that I was. And I said, can I help you with something? They said, well, you know, you may be able to. And I noticed that there was uniforms and suits present in the room. I thought I was in trouble. And the reason why I thought I was in trouble is I had just given an interview. I honestly trust the media. But I get it. This many years later, and I still fall over trash cans.
Yeah, right.
No smoother after all of those years. I thought I was in trouble because I had given an interview for the Rebel Yell newspaper. Mm-hmm. And the biology department was very upset because I hadn't cleared it with them first. And it was an interview that did not go well. So I figured I was in even deeper trouble with the university. And maybe these were Board of Regents people and they were involved with the university police or whatever. They fairly quickly cleared me up of that misapprehension. And basically asked me whether or not I was interested in a different lifestyle, an opportunity to have unlimited resources, unlimited working conditions, and working off the edge of the pizza, if you will. And now, I was 1986, so that's, 22 at the time?
22.
Who wouldn't say yes?
Yes, right.
Did I know that there was a connection between what they were offering me and years previous? Not a clue in the world. I had no idea what I was getting involved with. I figured that these people, actually, I figured they were military and this may be biological warfare. Enterprise. And at 22, a biology student, having just irritated my department, knowing that I wasn't going to get a committee letter from my department, would I jump on it? You darn right I did.
Well, sure you did. And from that, you had a roller coaster ride, so to speak. You ended up going out to a secret base, mm-hmm. which we know as Area 51 or S4.
Groom Lake.
Can we get into that when we come back? And
sure.
Paula Harris has something to talk to you about that, I'm sure.
Sure. Be happy to.
I'm Jerry Pippin, and we are talking to Dan Burrish and Marcia McDowell. I'm Wama Paula Harris. Don't go away. We'll be right back. It happened almost 60 years ago, but the debate still rages. Did an alien spacecraft crash outside Roswell, New Mexico in 1947? The most concise and complete series ever broadcast on Roswell, direct from Roswell. New programs added weekly. Check it out on the UFO Files on JerryPippin.com.
About 8 or 10 miles
left. This is Jerry Pippin along with Paula Harris, and we are at the UFO Congress in Laughlin, and our guest, Marcia McDowell and Dan Burrish. And as we left the show, we were talking about the fact, Paula, that he signed an agreement with MJ-12. We're going to follow up on MJ-12 in a little bit. Have you had experience with MJ-12 yourself as far as investigating?
Well, not overtly like this, where they announced their MJ-12. But I did do another story, and that's why I'm so interested in the Dan Burrish story. I did a story with Dr. Michael Wolf-Cravant, who worked in a similar area. He worked in, actually, he says he worked in S4, and I was totally convinced that some of the things that Dan was saying definitely supported Michael's story, and Michael is no longer with us, but, you know, I've had a lot of trouble with that story because it's really hard to verify. And I believe, this is my belief system as a journalist, that everyone should listen to the whole entire story before they make value judgments. So I totally support the fact that Dan is here to speak for himself and other people do not speak for him. It is very hard when we have to speak for the witness. We journalists, we researchers have to speak for you. And then we're the ones that get all the conflicts and so forth. Could discredit us from our jobs and so forth. And I'm really grateful, Dan, that you have come forward. Now, as far as the MJ-12 situation, the fact that it was sanctioned, what you were doing at S4, it was a sanctioned experiment or a sanctioned job, and that it was a positive kind of situation is maybe what we should get into, what the actual operation was.
Well, I understand. How long was it from 22 until you actually showed up out at S4?
My first trip into the Papoose facility was in 1990.
So you had still some education to go, and
indeed, I was tested for a large length of time. And in fact, there was a hiatus nearly immediately after the recruitment, after I went through a few of their training videos and some testing processes. And the training videos had an MAJ across the front of the TV screen, and it was on an angle, and I saw Madge. My only relationship to that is I actually thought that had to do with the Palmolive commercial. Remember, you're soaking in it. Remember old Madge?
Yeah, that goes
I had
back.
No idea what it was, and they weren't even telling me. I didn't know for a long period of time exactly even where Papoose was while they were transporting me there. I didn't know what the actual location was. And this was after assessments which occurred at Groom Lake, the popularized
area 51.
Right.
We should see the Papoose is Area 51. So, because for people that don't know, it's in the Area 51 complex.
It's in the general complex area.
Area 51. Okay.
It's in the general complex. It's technically at a different dry lake bed. But it's Groom.
Let's fast forward here to the first time. Did they tell you where you were going the first time you went out there?
Oh, no. For the longest time, I had been tested in what looked like a Winnebago out by the Silver Bowl. They actually parked in the parking lot by the Silver Bowl, and I was being tested inside that Winnebago.
In Las Vegas, right, Marcy?
Right. I had various levels of histopathological testing. Sam Boyd Silver Bowl.
Yeah, right.
And what they would do is they would flash slides at me, whether they would be normal mammalian or non-mammalian slides, everything from cytopathology to histopathology slides, and see how quickly I could read them. Now, Jim Reynolds had trained me up very well. And, of course, we can digress later, but I had found out, of course, that Jim Reynolds had been trained in his pathology duties, albeit I cannot directly say that the man has worked for any of the same associates, but he was trained for his duties at Wright-Patterson.
The actual thing that is kind of intriguing, the actual thing that's intriguing about this is while we were actually speaking with Dr. Reynolds about 2 years ago, where we had that reunion, he indicated that he had been trained at Wright-Patt, and he had been assigned to Long Beach the very year that Dan was born.
Mm-hmm. True.
So, asked him if he wanted to be a private or a captain.
Is that how they approached him?
Yeah, that was the phrase. He said, "Did you want to be a private or a captain in the service?" And he said, "Well, of course, I want to be a captain." So he was put on a different fast track, as it were.
And when we talk about that, you actually have been seen in Marine Corps uniforms, right, or Navy uniforms?
I was seen in a United States Naval uniform, and I, in fact, went through a short training process, a two-day training process on how to wear the United States uniform, yes, sir.
And so, technically, you had a military connection, even though you don't really consider that. It was more a Magic 12.
I was assigned to various labels, if you will, various titles. Whenever I had the opportunity and the honor to wear the uniform, I tried to do it with the same dignity as the individuals who were around me. And in fact, I had to unfortunately fight in the uniform in 91. That was unanticipated, but yet it happened.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these things do, but you know, when you went out there the first time, they put, did you go out on the famous airline, the private
the
airline?
Janus.
Oh, no, the first
Janus. Janus.
The first trip was not with Miss Janet. No.
Many subsequent trips were.
The first trip was actually out of Nellis Air Force Base.
Okay.
And it was a direct hop out of Nellis Air Force Base into the Groom Lake facility. Okay. I was taken from the aircraft at the Groom Lake facility, put into a small buggy, and taken into the Groom complex, where I entered a room and was taken down in an elevator to a very small wet prep lab that contained microscopes, and that's where the training and the testing evaluation continued.
How did you get to the Nellis facility, though?
I was driven there.
You were driven there. Okay, because I think you can't get on the Nellis facility.
No, I was driven there, and the gentleman had the right insignia on the vehicle, and they were
saluted in.
Some people
pick you up occasionally. I mean, you know,
quite
take
frequently.
You places.
Well, quite frequently.
My mom used to
watch me get picked up outside the apartment.
And finally
it got indiscreet enough because they were aware that certain looky-loo ladies who lived in the apartment complex were writing letters to certain newsmen.
Oh, really? We'll get into that, because they didn't write me.
Right. So what they ended up doing is they ended up parking down at the end of the street by the Channel 10 TV station.
Yeah,
that's where
right.
they finally ended up picking me up.
So you showed up there, you still didn't know what your job was going to be, right?
Oh, no, sir. I didn't know for certain what my job was until the end of 1993.
So you were there quite often, and you still didn't...
Quite often.
How did they spring J-Rod on you?
Well, what happened was after I was finally allowed into the Papoose facility and brought through the in-screening process. Now, the in-screening process is something that the public has not heard about. I'm certain that the public hasn't heard about it because they've heard, well, I might be able to walk out of there with this or that type of stable element, and that doesn't happen. You're stripped, you're weighed, and you're actually walked in. This is a positive pressure former biological warfare facility, and this is not, you know, a place where you can walk in. It's not a mom-and-pop filling station.
Gotcha.
You're screened in, and I was brought into the briefing book area, which was not that far from the nurse's office and around the corner from the clerical area. Following being brought in there, I was shown several of the DTIC books. It said DTIC across the front of the book, and they were part of what was called the King Tut training manuals. The King session was actually the operating... level that we were operating under for Aquarius J-Rod. We were the second unit that was being brought in, and I had a manual put in front of me which actually indicated to reticulum 4 in the mm-hmm. in the manual, and I was certain at that point that what we had been looking at for the previous couple years was what I was now reading about in the manuals. You see, we had been looking at ways to regress, if you will, or de-differentiate, if we're going to get into the biospeak, cells which have already gone to a terminal differentiation. And we were doing so with experimental chemicals at the time that are just now hitting the fore involving stem cell research, like reversing disubstituting.
So this 15, 16 years ago, and you were working with these things that are just now the
yes,
cutting
sir.
Edge.
Yes, sir. We were told to attempt, if we could, to strip an exterior cytoplasm off of an extremely small neuron. We didn't know why we were doing it, and in fact, for like I said, for the first year, maybe 2 years, I thought I was dealing with a chimera that may have been produced by a biowarfare agent. I didn't know. None of us knew. We gradually got together more and more on the trips that we were going up, first to Groom, then the hop down to Papoose, and we finally mounted an insurrection, if you will, against the command and said, pardon to speak, but what the hell are we dealing with here?
Uh-huh.
They finally then allowed us one by one to go through a briefing session, and that's where we were actually faced with the fact that we were dealing with something called an extraterrestrial entity.
Had you suspected that something like that was going on before, or you just thought it was biological, huh?
I suspected that it was a possibility because I grew up watching Star Trek like everybody else. But I did not expect that it was a reality. The first time that I saw the J-Rod in the clean sphere when we were brought up in the gallery, it's actually up into the gallery. There's a step up after you go down through the elevator system.
Now you wore one of those NASA-type suits or something?
Well, I was in to go up from past the biocontainment levels, I was in a BCL-2 uniform, a bunny, with a respirator, and then we went into the gallery area where we could remove our respirators after the sealants were locked. And then the clean sphere was... had been raised.
Why does the J-Rod could not live for a very long time in our atmosphere?
Well, it's a dual situation. Given the given the timeline that he was living with, he was used to a different partial pressure of oxygen. If you dealt with a J-Rod who came from an earlier time period, they could live for a longer period of time. But all the way until August 1991, there was actual hyperbaric therapy, which was going on the entity, on the little person, to try to assist him, as his natural physiology was promoted or moved along with higher partial pressures of oxygen, of hydrogen. So it got up to approximately 4%, if I'm recalling the partial pressure right, about 4% hydrogen to make him actually feel better. Otherwise, he was in pain. And, of course, they used pain as a...
behavioral modification?
That would be the best word for it. They used intumescence by changing the pressure to get him to a cattle prod, if you will,
to comply.
With the use of pressure for compliance.
Now, you actually developed a good relationship with him, even though at one time he did attack you, I think.
No, it wasn't an attack.
What was that?
You know,
story
I don't.
About?
Okay,
it wasn't
okay.
Can we start at the beginning? Didn't they tell you not to speak to him? Didn't they tell you not to get too close because he could project images in your brain?
We were not told not to get too close. I had to get right up to him to use the pin system on him for the removal of the samples. We were instructed what the protocol of contact would be and what we were supposed to do after. Now, of course, this is a long series of protocols to go through the drum systems, the plugging the drum systems, and into the clean sphere. But we actually... we're supposed to stand to the right after we got through the gantry area into the clean sphere onto the grate, the actual grate that he was standing on, and we were supposed to raise our right hand, and it would be projected next to us a form of a human being. A man's form would be projected, and then there would be a numerological sequence which would be projected to him, indicating that we were not there to harm him. Well, this was all garbage, because by the time I was within a few feet of the clean sphere, getting ready to actually be programmed in. I was in bunnies down on the clean sphere level before I was put through the medical and put into the TES, total encapsulated suit. I would write on the side of the clean sphere using a marker lot backwards. Well, I'm dyslexic, so that helped me. I would write the actual injection ports and the codes for it and the locations and the numbers backward on the side of the clean sphere near where he was sitting. And what he would do, nobody knew why, he would lean over and he would look at me and his finger would follow as I was writing on the clean sphere. And he was talking to me all along, right through the clean sphere. Anything within 30, 35 feet, I could hear him fine. In my own voice, but wrong cadence. You know, your own self-talk.
It just sound. Was the same pace.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. It was in a broken, a very broken pace, a very unusual syllabic mixture.
But so they can't control if he spoke to you. They can't control the communication because it's telepathic, right?
Not unless they induce pain.
No.
I don't know. They may have Sigma was working for years on methods to intercept, as in passive interception, because they use entrainment. to actually project thought, something like what a dolphin would use. The melanin in a dolphin would project a sound wave. They use entrainment, and they gradually figure out where your brain waves are, if you will, which of the various levels of brain waves, and which ones also cause you to relax, which is what the rogues use to steal people out of the middle of their...
We're going to follow up a little bit more about J-Rod, and then you really, Dan and Marcy, both of you feel you have a mission in life here that we want to get to and give you some time. We only have an hour show. We could do this for hours, but we would be remiss if we didn't follow up a little bit more about J-Rod. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we have Paula Harris with us as our co-host, and Marcy McDowell, and of course, Dan Burrish is our guest. Don't go away.
March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings, experiences.
It just didn't look like anything I'd ever seen in my life.
Hear about it on The Jerry Pippin Show.
Incredible show today, direct from the UFO Congress. I'm Jerry Pippin, along with Paula Harris. We have Dan Burrish and Marcy McDowell here. I'm sorry, Marcy. I must have complimented both of you. We're here in the lobby, just between shows or presentations, and it's hard to concentrate, but you guys are doing great.
Well, thank you.
We may sign you up for a maybe we won't.
The word "sign me up" put a pause to me there.
You were signed up once, weren't you?
20 years ago.
Yeah, that was enough. That was enough. Okay, so when you let's get back to your Area 51 and your J-Rod. I know for a fact that your father told me that you had a lot of compassion for J-Rod. That you felt he was in deep pain. He originally
introduced himself, he was physically and emotionally in deep pain. He introduced himself originally to me as captive.
Uh-huh.
Now, this was at a time that he also knew that he was giving himself willingly for the purpose of trying to find an amelioration to the neuropathy. He knew that his mother had given him for that purpose, that she knew of it. Every time I had to remove a sample, which came to several hundred finally, with the use of the PINS system, which was a pressurized avulsion sample removal system, mm-hmm. From his tissue, it caused him great peripheral pain. Now, at the time, I was speaking with him, so he was... and training me to his emotions as well. So every time I removed a sample from him, I felt it removed from my arm as well.
You're beginning to feel the pain yourself.
Indeed,
well,
sir.
In fact, it was so much so that you had to adopt a different way of utilizing the sampling device, because every time you would hit the pressure, if you were using the arm that it was sampled out of,
it hurt.
Then it, mm-hmm. it would cause a problem. So you had to actually modify your own way of doing the sampling.
Indeed I did. And however, in some cases with some of the peripheral nerve branches, there was nothing I could do. I needed to remove the sample, so I got it done. But they had warned us ahead of time.
This was a natural thing that had happened to him, not as a result of a crash or something.
This was a natural CIDP like chronic immune demyelinating polyneuropathy that also took on some very unusual other biological concerns that I'm sure the audience isn't going to be interested
in.
Actually,
they might be. Just give it a... You might as well just explain a little bit about it.
Okay, well, the J-Rods had a secretion system in their skin, magnified glandular system, paracrine and apocrine and a few Marocrine glands, which would actually produce various classes of antifreeze glycoproteins. Now, the man that I studied under, who led me ultimately to the higher degree level, I've got to be careful about this because of our agreements, was in fact an expert in glycoproteins. And in fact, one of my jobs during my education was to use his text and to essentially memorize it by rote. So I did. But the situation was that as the neuropathy progressed, the branches of the glandular system, which would produce the antifreeze glycoproteins, gradually became... Well, I wouldn't call it atrophied. I'd just say that it was exnervated. There was a pull-off, if you will, of the nervous tissue from the gland, thus causing the gland to under-secrete. Now, one of the functions, one of the evolutionary adaptations that they undergo is an increased exudation of that particular type of antifreeze glycoprotein to keep them warm. It's a matter of thermal hysteresis. One of the bad situations involved with this polyneuropathy, aside from the fact that there was pain involved and other tissue anomalies which would develop due to the loss of nerve function, also some coordination problems, et cetera, was the fact that they were not secreting sufficient antifreeze glycoprotein to keep themselves warm. So we had a hypothermia issue, and many of them were, in fact, succumbing to hypothermia.
Yeah,
so this was a progressive problem.
Inside the sphere, what was the temperature that he lived in?
It was extremely cold. We're talking in the 20 to 30 degree region. I don't know the exact Fahrenheit temperature.
And why was that? Was that more like his home planet? Or?
Well, it was more like Gliese, where he had actually become accustomed to.
Okay.
They produced a jump-off point in the Aquarius system, which is, in fact, the origin of the name for Project Aquarius. That, of course, was gobbled up and secreted back in 1953 when Aquarius was taken out from underneath U.S. Air Force control and taken into the IC community.
This is also called a Hotel Aquarius, so look at the synchronicity.
That's why we're here.
I wanted to talk about J-Rod somewhat because I think people are fascinated. You talked about all the problems that this being had. But, you know, the Ulhouse picture has him in clothes, in human clothes, and what you drew has him kind of oozing out. You said they had oozing out this kind of oil from his skin, but was he clothed?
What 7,000 years will do, huh?
Yeah.
The bottom line to the situation is that in 1953, in fact, there was a downed craft near Kingman. It went down in a rocky wash area. There were three occupants on board the craft. They were here for technological exchange, which Bill Uhouse was part of with one of the occupants. That occupant that he interacted with was taken to Los Alamos, a national facility, the laboratory at Los Alamos. The occupant that I interacted with was taken first to Groom Lake and then finally to the former biowarfare facility at Papoose. So these were two different J-Rods from 7,000 years different, and I drew the spy.
Now, when did you realize there was a timeline involved? Right off the bat, or did this... In other words,
the first person that actually told me that he was a traveler in time was the J-Rod, was Kaela.
He himself.
He was the first one that actually admitted to me where he was from and why. But he didn't tell me everything.
Did he want to go home or?
He did.
He did.
He did.
So
he also knew that he was serving a greater purpose by putting up with what he was putting up with.
Marcy, if you want to jump in here too, in your own idea about were we treating him correctly or not?
I don't think so. My personal impression, no.
Yeah.
No, we weren't.
When
we first got hold of him, we thought that he was part of the rogue contingent from the group that he was actually infiltrating to try to gather information. Immediately he was locked down, and he started calling himself a captive because he wasn't part of that group. That was one of the people that U-House, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, that U-House was interacting with. This particular person found himself locked down, and he was not happy. And he was also being, in my opinion, mistreated by the behavior modification methods that they chose to employ when he wasn't as cooperative as they wanted him to be.
True.
So I don't think it was well treated at all.
It sounds like they were going and zapping him or something.
Well, they would use pressure, and the pressure increases created an awful lot of pain, and he was already suffering because of a neuropathy. I'm not the scientist. So that made it worse.
His tissues.
It was terrible.
His tissues. Now, I'm going to use the word density here. And coming into contact with that word with some of the individuals that I've spoken with during the time that I've had a chance to interact with the public, they may be using the term a little bit differently than I'm intending upon its use. I'm meaning mass over volume. His density was significantly less. He was less dense physically. His tissues were of greater hydration, and he was less dense. There was greater distance, if you will, between the cells.
In other words, are you saying more liquid?
In fact, yes, right. Yes. Right. He was right. much more liquid-like, very jelly-like. And so when there was a pop of the repress valve, when they would intumesce him, it would cause him to collapse on the floor of the clean sphere and writhe in pain.
You also mentioned that he had a family, and this is the thing that really got to me, because I had been told by Clifford Stone, who had done crash retrievals, that some of these beings have families, and he mentioned he had a son.
Indeed,
so
and he was in great pain because he could not, at the time that, well, he wanted to go back to ultimately see his son again. Go forward, if you will. Go forward. It's one of those paradoxical
issues. We'll get into that in a minute because we've kind of glossed over that. But a lot of people are familiar with the story. Go ahead, Dan.
He expressed to me personally a great deal of pain for not being able to show his son how he felt openly. And his son couldn't show it back to him, because if his son did, he would appear out of line with his own culture. And emotions and families, they had breeding groups, but they had, a loose family system, but the love was still there, the heart was still there, the human heart was still present.
How did they procreate? Same way as us?
Bisexual intercourse.
Except
there are innovations involving their external genitalia.
Different techniques, which we won't get into on this show.
I don't really think I want to, no.
Rather steer clear of that.
Look, if I fall into trash cans just looking at females, yeah. What can I say?
Now, tell us briefly. The future is not good, and they're coming back to try to change it. What is happening here?
No.
The future is great, then.
The future is what we make it.
Okay.
No more, no less. We're in a time right now, a time that we've been in since 1980. This is a time of the passage of the sun on the plane of the galaxy. It's a time which has been foretold and looked for in the last, I guess it was 5,125 years of the Mayan calendar. It's a time that 12,800 years ago, the Vedic literature called a golden age. It's a time that around the same amount of time ago, the ancient Egyptians called the zero time, the Zepi Tepi, a time of great promise. Just because we've interacted with these creatures of a various timeline doesn't posit for us the tragedies of their history. We make our future for ourselves. And what I see with the people and the promise that I see around the world today is a positive future for humanity. Now, indeed, their future records that a great catastrophe occurred on or about now.
Right.
And so what? And so what? We're here now. You're sitting across the table from me. You folks are sitting across the table. We're here now. We're the people who are making the future for everyone and for ourselves. So just because there are paradoxes which have occurred and which may be overlaying here and there in our perception, people have time shifts and this sort of thing, and there's more and more of it occurring, the closer we're getting, I think, to that divergence time or that convergence time, however you want to look at it. But we've been in this time now since 1980. We're in the time, in accordance with what I have learned from the Majestic, which was called, and beware, because I'm going to keep talking here after the word, the season of catastrophe from the Cross of Hyundai, from 92 to, I believe it is, 2012, which was considered the greatest time of risk, and so what? We know the things from their history, which according to their history, promoted their own history to produce a catastrophe. Now, look, we have a problem knowing what happened 2,000 years ago. The little person that I had the great privilege to speak with from 94 through 96 and then again at the end of 2003 is talking about something that happened 52,000 years before his time. 52,000 years. We've got a hard time dealing with something that just happens a few hundred years ago. Of course, histories are written by the victors, too. These are human beings that we're talking about here. Human beings lie. The ones which are closer to us, meaning the ones 45,000 years ahead, lie more. However, the one that I was interacting with was a good enough liar to be a spy.
Really?
So, could he lie? Sure. Sure. But the operating knowledge that we worked under was in concert with what I was hearing from him as well. So, you could say that we were all agreeing upon a lie, or we all knew what was the truth. The best we can do is interpret from what we've learned. We make the future for ourselves. So this catastrophism business is a bunch of nonsense.
Thanks for saying that, because this has been one of the problems around your story, okay? And you at least have it cleared it up.
Well, look, the Mayan calendar has nothing to do with a lot of this transient doomsday catastrophism business. Yes, the Mayans said that we were going to face a time of cyclic change. They believed in cycles. They believed that we would enter a chaotic period before a time of renewal. Renewal doesn't say death. It says renewal. We're going to be fine.
On an optimistic note from Dan Burrish, we're going to take a break. Paula Harris, Marcy McDowell, and Jerry Pippin will be back in a moment.
The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers. UFO and alien disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. Video you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD. Anytime, anywhere. Fast Walkers, now available on DVD for only $19.95 at shopjerrypippin.com.
People have been making it a problem.
Your story. Yeah, they've been latching on to the things that I have said, and they've been adding on to them and saying, oh, this is Planet X. Oh, this is Nibiru. No.
Yeah.
It is what I experienced and no more. Now, if somebody wants to add to it, there's nothing I can really do about that or say about that, aside from the fact that's not what I'm saying.
You're listening to Paula Harris, Marcy McDowell, and Dan Burrish, and we're discussing some of the misconceptions and the spin other people put on things. And that's one reason you both have agreed to do the show today, and we appreciate you coming by. This is Jerry Pippin. We're at the UFO Congress. Only one more thing, and then we'll get into you're going to do a series of DVDs, and what are they going to find on these DVDs? We'll ask in just a second, but I want to follow up. You mentioned MJ-12. Admiral McConnell has been rumored to be one of the top guys, if not number one, by many people. He just was appointed to a top government position. Did you ever meet Admiral McConnell? Or can you say?
What I can say is what I said in a formal statement to the public, that and this was prior to the retired Vice Admiral's nomination hearing before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. And that is that I could have thought of no better individual to set in the position of in the office of the DNI than he.
Then you do
save that. Save that. I
perhaps respectfully decline to.
In other words, you have personal knowledge of him. You've been with him, probably.
Well, happened?
I'm just assuming that.
What's happened is this: on August the 12th of 2005, I was provided with an unambiguous set of final orders, and that was to complete the debriefing that had already begun, ostensibly just for archival purposes. I had no intention on the debriefing. As God is my witness, I had no intention on it even becoming public. I was going to hand the archive to her, and wherever it was going to go from there, it was going to go, and I was going to go back to my research, which I'd really like to do any time.
And yet here we are.
But the set of orders was unambiguous, and that was that I was to apply my good word, my sacred honor, and tell the truth about what I experienced. So I debriefed for many, many hours over all of these subjects, and from what I understand now from Marcia, she is in fact going to put these out. Well, we had a short period of time that I was supposed to put out a particular set of information which contained the truth of the situation in which we currently find ourselves, and the truth involving the so-called Greys, the J-Rods. I did so, and we named it Tell the World. Actually, she
named it Tell the World.
Tell the World.
We have a few of those DVDs at my table after this talk.
And for our listening audience and people around the world, you have they're available on your website,
yes.
Right, Marcy?
Yes, the EaglesDisobey.net website. We have them available for anybody who would like them. We're also going to be doing several more. The first one had to be done on a particular time frame in order to comply with orders. However, I'm at my discretion to do the rest of them. And there's so much material in the debriefing that we've already got in the can, it seems a shame not to share it with people.
Now, speaking for a moment about orders.
Are you retired?
I am, sir.
Okay.
In the final set of orders, which were unambiguous to me, it did not say that I was to name the individuals who had been seated members of either the 12 or the Committee of the Majority, which preceded them as their cover committee. On the Jeff Rentz radio show, in fact,
you went to the edge of the pizza on that.
Went near the razor and provided initials for the individuals who were last seated in the 12, and they are true and correct to the best of my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
However, I can't make these individuals, men and women, stand up, erect themselves, and speak to the world the truth that they told me to basically be the bag man for. I can't do that. I'm not their apologist. They have to live with themselves, and they've got to talk to their God. I have to talk to mine. What I will say is this. You've been lied to. They've been telling you that your vain speculation should not be undeceived by your senses, that you are not seeing what you are seeing, You've not had happen to you what has happened to you, and it has. I don't have permission to say this, but I did hold a number for a very short period of time, so that makes me responsible. On behalf of the 12, I apologize. I'm sorry. I'm sorry you've been lied to. I'm sorry the government has decided that you couldn't handle the truth. I apologize to you.
This is, Paula, what this is really all about is that Dan has a lot of emotion, a lot of ethics. I mean, at one time, I think you were going to be a priest, weren't you, Dan?
Yeah, but this is what
happens.
Yes, sir.
Well, see, they broke off the training with me nearly after they started it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I still hear the same calling. That was honest. I was going to go in, and in fact, I entered St. Patrick's Seminary in Menlo Park, California, and I had full intention of becoming a priest. They said that it would be, because they recontacted me prior to entrance to St. Patrick's, they said, well, it'll probably be a good idea you get right with God. And I said, I don't think you folks understand. I'm really planning on going through to ordination, so if we can work this out with the church.
Yeah, you're right.
But after a short period of time in St. Patrick's, I decided that there was many ways to follow God, and that what I was seeing was incompatible with my personal view on how I was to follow the God that I have to talk to before I go to sleep every night.
Yeah, and the reason I even brought this subject up is how do you square all of this, your early religious teachings and what you now believe? I mean, is it together or is it totally a different shock?
I imagine you could call me a lapsed Catholic. Now, I haven't been to church in a great period of time, but I pray every night to the same God
okay.
that everyone
in,
does.
In other words, what I'm getting to is...
It only magnifies God. What I experienced as part of Majestic, and yes, I'm a scientist. I do believe in you know, the weighing out of items and the testing of items, but science is a whim of humankind. It's new on the scene. God isn't.
Did J-Rod have a religious faith?
Indeed. He had a cosmic belief in a cosmic love, a cosmic mechanic, if you will, that he referred to in the same way as Christ.
In other words, agape love, that type
right.
of thing that you talked about
regarded,
in seminary.
He regarded our view of the Ankh as being the true cross because of the symbolism of it being the plane of the galaxy and the loop above and then to below it, which we can also, you know, regard as the tear sack and the...
So do you think there's a certain timing to this? This is why you feel the way you do about talking. I feel the way you do about apologizing. This is... A lot of witnesses have come forth, and Colonel Philip Corso is the one I'm thinking of right now. A lot of witnesses have come forth to say it's time to tell the truth. And do you consider yourself... Because of the timing right now that it's the case.
If I didn't... of course, I came at your behest, but if I didn't believe that the truth needed to be told, I wouldn't be sitting here. I don't see myself sitting in a period of history. I'm just here now. I think history needs to judge the time now, and I don't think that I'm capable of doing that. What I see is where we are now and the promise that we have in our future, and that's what... I'm focusing on, and hopefully within the next few years you're going to be maybe hearing something very promising from our research.
We're
heading towards something.
Dan, you're in my
much.
Book, and I'm going to talk about the Exopolitics book. Your interview is in my book because it's very important. It talks about two things, time travel and stargates. And time travel and stargates are two of the very key points of the whole UFO phenomenon. And I think that people should listen to what you have to say because you're trying to tell us as much as you possibly can without going over about these two situations. And the fact that we can change a timeline, we can change it, it's entirely up to us, gives hope for humanity.
Moment by moment, the consciousness studies which are present now with Princeton, for instance, with the Global Consciousness Project, the eggs that they have worldwide, and various consciousness studies which are going on prove the power of positive thought, that we're creating our own future with our positive thought. And I see a renaissance in our future. This is what I honestly see for us. And I hope that in some small way, with the research that we're doing, we may be able to help with that. I hope to God that we can.
Are a lot of ETs with us and among us now? Or are they all time travelers? I guess they are one way or the other.
The only extraterrestrial intelligences which I was directly involved with, and this includes involving the Tau 9 Treaty situation, were Orions, which were at P plus 52,000 years, a set of J-rods at the same time frame, which was the time frame of Kaela, and a P plus 45,000 J-rod, which we call the Rogues, which are extremely self-centered. They are the ones that experiment on us. And I did what I could as part of, for the short period of time that I was involved
like
with the treaties,
turn
to
about
stop
fair play,
to stop
experimenting with J-Rod.
Well, it's not, okay. And I'm going to tell you why it's not.
Okay,
it was a programmed operation within the Committee of the Majority, and then finally within the final Majestic group prior to their quiescence. It was a programmed issue to allow a certain number of world citizens to be picked up in the middle of the night. I was one of them.
And we talked about it early in the program. Right.
I'm just like you, if it happened to you. No better, no worse. And that is wrong. And I stood up against that, or at least I tried to, with what small voice I had at the time. And I also tried to pull certain things to help politically move it in a different direction.
Well,
and finally, when the final treaty was signed, the 9-6 treaty, it was in fact removed as an official treaty option. There is no need to justify a wrong. And I wouldn't personally sit there at a treaty negotiation table and say, yeah, it's fine. It's fine because what? People are not going to know that we're doing it? I have to look at myself in the mirror every morning. Do they.
What did they get in response for picking up people? What was the deal like? I mean, you could pick up people and then we get something?
They received a certain number of people that they could randomly or by statistical population sampling pickup to attempt to ameliorate the problem on their own as part of their agreement not to set other agreements with other countries, which is what set the Committee of Majority in place in the first place. In 1963, this was brokered so that the Soviets would not start brokering their own treaties with the Rogues. I'm sorry for being passionate about it, but
no,
people are being hurt, and it's wrong.
What's the future bring us on this issue alone? Is Majestic still in business?
Majestic is not.
Okay.
There is a new group, and there is a permanent wall.
And what do you think about the new group?
I don't know. I have met liaisons from the new group, but only met liaisons. And
overall,
I really don't want to poke my nose
anymore
because I'm tired.
And our time's almost up, but overall, you're fairly optimistic, and looks like maybe we've done a lot of things that weren't right, but maybe the future will change. You seem to be optimistic about it.
I am.
Very optimistic.
I am.
That's one reason you came here, I think.
When you get human beings in the mix, you always have problems. But yes, I'm optimistic for the future. I'm optimistic for a bright future for us, and I'm optimistic because people are learning. They are understanding what's going on around them, and there are more and more cracks in the eggshell, so more and more light is starting to shine in. And the more light you shine in, the more the demons will run away.
We have only a minute left. Anything you need to bring out here that we haven't covered? Either one of you? Did we do a pretty good job?
Just for me to say thank you to you.
Yeah, I've enjoyed meeting you, Dan. We've talked many times. Marcy and
great
I.
Great pleasure. Thank you so much.
We're old pals by now. And Paula is just an asset to this whole UFO agreement, and last year when she went down to meet with you guys, that was wonderful.
Well, we feel really privileged to be a part of your presentation and actually to be friends with you both.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually our privilege.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you're writing some of this for Area 51 magazine.
Yeah,
I know.
Area 51 magazine. It's in Italian, but it still gets disseminated all over the world.
Anyway,
but I just know that the world knows. Yeah, the world knows what's happening, and it is a planetary situation, and we need to remember that.
Okay, one more time, your website.
EaglesDisobey.net.
And we have a link to that, of course. And that's our time's up. Thanks, Paula Harris. Thanks, Marcy McDaniel. McDowell, I keep wanting to call you. And also Dan Burrish. It's always been a pleasure talking to you. Even on Christmas Eve, we corresponded one time.
Indeed, we did.
Yes, we did.
Yes.
And so it's been a pleasure. And thanks for coming by and going public with us.
Thank you.
And our on-location producer is Roberta Scott. I got to get her title right, because yesterday I said she was in studio, and that's not true. That's Jane Swartley, who's editing the shows. See, I got to live with these people. I got to get it right. And I did this time. Thanks very much, everybody.
Thank you.
This is Jerry Pippin. Until next time, cheers.
The doors are finally open at shopjerrypippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition t-shirt selections features 3 different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector t-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at shopjerrypippin.com.